All right, so I guess, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for the chance to speak to you. So as Kevin said, I'm going to be talking about compatibly split subvarieties of the Hilbert scheme of points in the affine plane. And everything here is done under supervision of Alan Knutson, my advisor. Okay, so what's the plan? Well, first of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about the general case of the entire Hilbert scheme. And of course, I'm not going to assume that everybody here knows about the Hilbert scheme, so I'll briefly introduce it. Then the point of this talk is to stratify the Hilbert scheme by some, nice subvarieties. So I'm going to do an example of that, introduce some Frobenius splitting, and the algorithm that I'm going to use in general. Give you some examples. And we'll see that it's a little bit difficult, actually, to tackle this problem in general, so I'm going to restrict to an open patch and see what can be said there. Okay. Just one thing to note, for the purposes of the talk, because we're going to be talking about Frobenius splitting and it's a characteristic P notion, K will be algebraically closed characteristic P. Okay, so the Hilbert scheme. So as a set, I'm not going to worry too much beyond that, we define the Hilbert scheme to be these co-length n ideals in K of x, y. And in a particular way, we say that an ideal corresponds to n points in the plane. Okay, so what do I mean, in case you haven't seen this? So the following is true. Sort of on one extreme, we can have these radical ideals. And then if they're co-length to n, they correspond to n distinct points in the plane. Okay. On the other extreme, you could have a local ring. And then the support is at a single point. But you have this stat point of supported at this single point AB. And what's sort of interesting to note is that if you're talking about the Hilbert scheme of n points in the plane, then the dimension of the subvariety that's supported at a single point is n minus 1. So there are lots of possibilities. And I have just three examples in Hilbert 3. Okay. And then, of course, more generally, you could have some points here, and some points here, and some points here. Okay, so some properties. I mean, I just described the Hilbert scheme as a set to you, but without getting, without really describing the scheme structure, it turns out that the Hilbert scheme is actually really nice. The Hilbert scheme of points in the plane is really nice. In particular, it's non-singular, connected, reduced and irreducible, and it has dimension 2n. I guess it's interesting to note that if we're talking about Hilbert schemes of points in other spaces, such as 3 space, these properties don't hold, or some of them don't hold anymore. For example, if you're talking about A3, then you don't have the smoothness anymore. Okay. All right, so the torus acts on the Hilbert scheme by scaling points. It's sort of the induced action from the action of the torus on affine space. So I guess that's probably enough to say about the Hilbert scheme. So as I said before, what I'm going to be doing is discussing a specific stratification of the Hilbert scheme. Okay? And just before I start telling you really what that stratification is, one thing to note is that the subvarieties that we'll be stratifying with, the locally closed strata, that is, the subvariety minus the stuff below it, will be reduced, regular in codimension 1, and stable under the torus action. So let's start with a small example. Okay, so we start with the Hilbert scheme of 2 points in the plane, and this divisor that says at least 1 point is on an axis. Okay, so there are 2 components of this divisor. And they'll be our codimension 1 subvarieties. Okay. So we can intersect the irreducible components of this divisor and then decompose the intersection to obtain these 2 new subvarieties. And I'm using these pictures to denote sort of a general point in the subvariety. Okay, so this would be one point is on the y-axis and one point is on the x-axis. Okay, so we get those two components. So, of course, sort of the neat thing to notice is that these subvarieties, or these subschemes, are actually reduced. And, of course, that doesn't happen in general for intersections, but in this case it does. Now, before I said that we wanted all of the strata to be regular in codimension 1, but it turns out each of the components of the divisor is not, so we'll include the non-R1 locus. That is the locus of, or the singular, the component of the singular locus in codimension 1. And in our case, it's two points lie on the y-axis or two points lie on the x-axis. So now I'm going to do the same procedure. These will be my list. The top line is my list of codimension 2 subvarieties. I take each one and I intersect it with the union of the others, and I get the following codimension 3 subvarieties. And I do the procedure once more, and I get the T2 fixed points. Okay, so from this sort of procedure that may not seem so motivated yet, I get this stratification of the Hilbert scheme. And sort of the thing to note is that all of these subvarieties are reduced. And in fact, they're reduced because they're all of the compatibly Frobenius split subvarieties. Okay, so more generally then, we can ask the question, well, what happens if we are looking for all of the compatibly Frobenius split subvarieties of the Hilbert scheme of n points of the plane? And to study this question, I'll talk about an algorithm of Alan Knudsen and David Speyer and Thomas Lamb, which makes precise the procedure that I used on the Hilbert scheme of two points in the plane, which is the intersect, decompose, include the non-R1 locus. But I mean, before I describe the algorithm, I'm going to discuss just a little bit about Frobenius splitting, because I'm talking about stratifying the Hilbert scheme by Frobenius split subvarieties. Okay. So I'm going to just talk about the case of affine schemes for now. So I'm going to let R be a commutative K-algebra. Remember, K is this characteristic P field. And we'll say that R is Frobenius split if we have this map, phi, that's linear, where phi of A plus B is phi of A plus phi of B, has the second property that phi of A to the P times B is A times phi of B, and that also 1 goes to 1. And you might say, well, why is it a splitting? And it splits the Frobenius. So what's something that's really sort of easy to see right off the bat? Well, if R is Frobenius split, then it doesn't have any nilpotents. Why? Well, suppose you had a nilpotent. You can raise it to the sort of highest power before it vanishes, apply phi. Now you're raising it further, it vanishes and you get 0. So that would be that's a contradiction. Okay, so that's nice. So immediately we see that, well, if we're Frobenius split, then we get reduced. And that's one of the properties we're going to use. Okay, I mentioned compatibly split before. So what does that mean? Well, if I is an ideal, that just means that phi of I is contained in I, or really phi of I is equal to I. And in this case, that means that we get an induced splitting from on the quotient, because phi of I maps into I. And so by the first sort of immediate consequence, that means R mod I is reduced and I is a radical ideal. So again, all the compatibly split subvarieties are going to be reduced. Okay. So what are some things that we've used already about Frobenius splitting? Well, in the two-point case, what did we do? We started with these two components of the divisor, and we intersected them, and we decomposed them, and we took the non-R1 locus, and we said at the end that, oh, all of these are the compatibly split, or we get compatibly split subvarieties at each stage. And this is true in general. Intersections, unions, and components of compatibly split subschemes are compatibly split. Again, it's not difficult to see that, just looking at ideals. And the non-R1 locus of any compatibly split subvariety is compatibly split. Okay, so I'm not really going to be using explicit for Benia splittings in the sense that I'm not going to be defining a fee. Really what I'm going to be using is this divisor that induces a splitting in a specific way. And I'm not going to tell you sort of how that works, but we do need to know that we can do this. So if you want to learn more about Frobenius splitting in general, you can see this book by Brian and Kumar called Frobenius Splitting in Algebraic Geometry and Representation Theory. But in any case, for now, let's just let X be a non-singular or more generally a normal scheme. And the divisor specifically that we're going to be interested on X is the anticanonical. And you can think of that as sort of the top exterior power of the, or a section of the top exterior power of the tangent bundle. Okay? So why are these divisors important? Well, these certain anticanonical divisors induce in a specific way a Frobenius splitting on X, such that all of the compatibly split codimension 1 subvarieties are the components of the divisor. And in fact, all of the compatibly split subvarieties, which is something that we use, are contained inside of this divisor or inside the singular locus of X. And that's due to Kumar Mehta. Okay, so what are some divisors that induce splitting? Well, suppose we're on affine space. If there's some term order on the variable such that the initial term is the product of the variables, then we get a splitting on affine space, given by V of F. Okay. So one splitting that we'll see later on is this standard splitting, where the divisor that we use is just the product of the variables. And then, of course, the initial term is the product of the variables. So sort of using this fact that components are compatibly split and intersections are compatibly split and unions are compatibly split, what we can do is we can take the components of this divisor, which are all the coordinate hyperplanes, and we can intersect them, and we can decompose and intersect and decompose, and we get all of the coordinate subspaces. And this is exactly the set of compatibly split subvarieties of affine space under this splitting. So that's an example. But the one really that we're interested in is this one. Is that it's a theorem of Kumar and Thompson that the anticanonical divisor defined by this at least one point is on one of the coordinate axes induces a Frobenius splitting on the Hilbert scheme. So now I can sort of, that I've introduced a little bit about Frobenius splitting, I'm going to define the algorithm or describe the algorithm that I'm going to use to look for compatibly split subvarieties of the Hilbert scheme using this divisor. Okay. So what do we start with? We start with, of course, our Frobenius split variety and the divisor that induces the splitting. So this partial X is the divisor that induces the splitting. Okay, so what do we do? Well, we take the components of partial of X, and, well, if X is regular in codimension 1, that is, the singular locus is in higher codimension, then this algorithm returns a bunch of pairs. It returns each of the components of the divisor that we started with and the intersection of that component of the divisor with the rest of them. Okay. So you can note that again, by properties of Frobenius splitting, that each of these DI intersect EIs are going to be compatibly split inside of DI. Okay, what if X is not regular in codimension 1? Well, we have to do something a little different. We have to first include the non-R1 locus, because we saw that that's compatibly split. And then we return the normalization, comma, the preimage under the normalization map of this partial X union the non-R1 locus. Okay? So I'm going to do an example of this. So if you're not totally sure, that's okay. So we can repeat these steps sort of over and over again until you can't do it anymore, and it will terminate. But there's one more sort of thing you have to consider, is that before I said that all of the compatibly split subvarieties of some scheme X were contained either inside of the divisor or inside of the singular locus. And sort of here we're considering the part that's contained inside of the divisor. So you do have to be careful at each stage and check for compatibly split codimension greater than or equal to two subvarieties inside of the singular locus, and this is difficult to do. Okay, so let's go back to the Hilbert scheme of two points example. We already stratified this using the compatibly split subvarieties, but let's use the algorithm this time. Okay, so start with the Hilbert scheme of two points, and it's anti-canonical. One point is on the y-axis union, one point is on the x-axis, and we apply one. So what is that? We take the first component and we intersect it with the second component, and we decompose. And so we get the first list. Second list is the same thing. You take the second component, intersect it with the union, and you decompose. There's sort of a symmetry there, so we'll just continue with the first of the two pairs. So sort of recall from before that the each of the components of the divisor is not regular in codimension 1. And if you want to see that, suppose you have that subvariety, then you have this finite birational map from that subvariety. That's not an isomorphism. So this is not normal, and it fails to be an isomorphism along the subvariety where there are two points on this axis because of the two possible orders of the points. So we need to include the non-R1 locus and then normalize. Okay, so we continue, and you can see what happens. We apply one, and then we apply it again, and we get the T2 fixed points. So I'm not going to spend, I guess, too much more time describing this, but that's the idea. It's sort of a sequence of intersecting, decomposing, and normalizing. Okay, then this is the same poset that we had before. Okay, so just one thing to note, as I said before, we really do need to be careful about checking inside of the singular locus. Here's an example. Let P be 1 mod 3, and if we consider the splitting on affine 3 space that's determined by that divisor, then we can't apply, if this is irreducible, we can't apply either component either step in the algorithm. But nevertheless, the origin is compatibly split, and we wouldn't find it just by applying the algorithm. But in the case of Hilb 2, just applying those steps 1 and 2 was enough. So there's that picture again. I guess I should say a few words about what these subvarieties mean. So some of them are sort of self-evident. The top one is just just the Hilbert scheme. The codimension 1 ones are the components of the divisor. One point is on the y-axis or one point is on the x-axis. Here now, a general point is one point is at the origin. Here we have the two points are at the origin, but because we're remembering how they came into the origin. So we're remembering sort of the slope. And here we have the torus 6 points, the monomial ideal. So what about for the Hilbert scheme of three points in the plane? Well, it's getting a little bit more complicated. Again, you see we have all of the subvarieties where we have some points on one axis and some points on the other axis. But now we can have more configurations of points at the origin. We have this guy, which you can sort of think of as you had two points sitting vertically and one point coming in arbitrarily, and they're all at the origin. Or most ideals in this subvariety look like y cubed, sort of like that. and there's a whole P1 worth of these. So this subvariety is isomorphic to P1. This is sort of the symmetric one, isomorphic to P1. And these are the monomial fields written as partitions in the standard way. And all of those are convenient split. Okay, I'm not going to worry too much about this picture, but really the point is that it becomes really hard to understand what's going on. Again, we see all of the subvarieties that we had before by adding either points on the axis or points freely, and we obtain these from the algorithm, and we get some more configurations of points at the origin, which I'm not really going to care too much about. This one, I mean, these pictures are sort of maybe not so self-explanatory. But you can think of them just sort of as intersections of certain of these subvarieties above, right? But I'm not going to focus too much on that. It's not really the point. This is isomorphic. This subvariety of points at the origin turns out to be isomorphic to a P2. And one of these, I can't remember which one, I think this one is some curve, a degree 2 curve inside of the P2, and this one is a P1. And then we get some of the monomial ideals, not all of the monomial ideals, being compatibly split, namely the one that would correspond to the box, the 2 and 2, x squared, y squared. That monomial ideal is not compatibly split. So it sort of becomes hard to see what's going on. Okay, so, but I mean, what can we say? As I said before, the poset of compatibly split subvarieties for smaller Hilbend is contained inside the ones for larger Hilbend by adding points. You get all the subvarieties where some of the points are on this axis and some of the points are on this axis and some are floating freely. But as I said before, even with monomial ideals, we can't, even these codimension zero, or these top codimension subvarieties, we can't really totally understand which ones are compatibly split. In Hilb 2 and 3, we get all of them. In Hilb 4, we don't. In Hilb 5, we do, I believe. So it's confusing, at least to me. So what are we going to do now? The point is, this was sort of hard. Let's restrict to an open affine patch. So what's the patch? Well, the open affine patch I'm going to consider is one of the that I'm going to call U sub lambda. So lambda is going to be a monomial ideal, and U sub lambda is going to be the set of all ideals in the Hilbert scheme such that the monomials outside of lambda form a vector space basis of K of X, Y mod I. So for example, if lambda is Y squared X in the Hilbert scheme of 2 points, then that ideal is contained in U sub lambda because the monomials outside of monomials outside of lambda, which are 1 and y in this case, the monomials not in the ideal, do form a vector space basis for k of x, y mod I. Okay? So this use of lambda is going to be the collection of all of these ideals. Okay? So for the remainder of the talk, I'm only going to be concerned with this one specific u lambda. This is the one that I've looked at, which is the generalization of the one above, this y to the n x. So just to describe it a little bit better, I can write all of the elements in U lambda as ideals generated by these polynomials. And you might say, well, why bother with the ones in the middle? Right? Why not just take this guy and this guy? But later on we'll see that this is actually a useful way of writing it. Okay. And so my coordinates on U sub lambda, which you can see now is going to be isomorphic to affine 2 space, are going to be these guys and those guys. And all of the rest of these polynomials, which I obtain by basically specifying that the ideal is co-length n, by computing some S pairs, say that are polynomials in the other coordinates. So this U lambda for this particular lambda is affine space. In general, that's maybe not true. Maybe you just get an affine variety. Okay, so we want to discuss Frobenius splittings, and so what do we do? We have this open affine subvariety, and we want to know what is the splitting on that, for the induced splitting on that. So you take the anticanonical on your original space and you intersect it with the open affine patch, and then this induces a splitting on the open patch. And the compatibly split subvarieties are going to be these subvarieties, the compatibly split subvarieties of X intersect the compatibly split subvarieties, the open affine. Okay. So we can now ask the hopefully easier question, what are all the compatibly split subvarieties of this affine patch of the Hilbert scheme? Maybe this is more understandable. Okay. So let's just look at Hilb 2. I already put up this picture a number of times. If you look to the left of this red line, we get all of the subvarieties that have non-empty intersection with U sub lambda, right? U sub lambda you can think of sort of as the patch around that fixed point, and so certainly this one is not in the patch, and those two are not. Okay. And just sort of something that's interesting to note maybe is that, well, we start off with one subvariety, and then there are two, and then three, two, one. This poset sort of has the shape of a square with some extra covering relations, but that's maybe hopeful. Okay, we do the same thing for Hilb 3, and the same thing happens. Again, we have extra covering relations in the poset, but again, it sort of has a nice shape. Okay, and then the same thing for Hilb 4. Okay, so maybe I should go back for a second. If we spend a little bit of time looking at what subvarieties do we actually get. Well, we notice that we can only ever have one point on the x-axis. If we were to have two, we wouldn't be inside of our affine patch anymore that's centered around this vertical fixed point. And in the three-point case, we have, I guess, most of the configurations of points in the origin. But if we go back to the four-point case, we're missing a whole bunch the new ones that we obtained. Pardon me? Oh, sorry. Lambda is for always. And so n will vary, but that's always lambda. Okay. So we can generalize to say that we get at least the following types of these subvarieties, or these following subvarieties. And I say at least because I'm pretty sure that this is all we get. I have sort of most of a proof, but I'm missing some details. So I don't want to say 100% that this is all we get. But first of all, let me explain the subvarieties, and then I'll say that by counting dimensions, we get a square. Okay. So the first subvariety is just sort of, we get these k points on the y-axis and l points floating freely. The second one is now we have a point freely on the x-axis. Now we have some points at the origin, and I'm drawing it like this to denote that this is sort of, at least if we sort of ignore the rest of the points, that looks like that vertical fixed point, that one that's of this form. And here we have sort of an A1 worth of points at the origin, where you can think of as most of the points are sort of vertically separated, all but one, and one has come in sort of at an arbitrary angle, and there's an A1 worth of that. So that's sort of understandable, or at least can be described sort of combinatorially. And as I said, I can't tell you 100% right now that I have a proof that this is all that occurs, but under this under the stratification by these subvarieties, we do again get this shape of the square. So let's sort of understand what are the properties of these subvarieties. I mean, we know they're compatibly split, and so they're reduced, but maybe there are other things we can say. Okay, so let's look at the divisor that determines the splitting. So again, we started off with, on the Hilbert scheme, this divisor, at least one point is on this axis, at least one point is on this axis, and this has two components, and so on the affine space, U lambda, we should expect two reducible polynomials that describe this divisor. And let's just look at this in a specific example. So in Hilb 2, we get that our ideal sort of a general point in the U sub lambda contained in Hilb 2. I'm using U sub lambda for all different n, but hopefully you see what I mean, is defined by that. And if there's at least one point on the x-axis, well, what does that say? Well, all of these ideals should have, when I add the ideal y, I should not get 1, right? So add y, on the top row, the first two terms disappear, and we get minus b2 remaining. So minus b2 better not be 0. B2 better be 0. Okay, so similarly, you do the same thing. If I plus x is not 1, then, well, what happens? We get that sort of this determinant is not 0. And we get that this equation, that is the product of minus b2 with that determinant, determines the splitting on U lambda contained in Hilb 2. One thing to notice is that if you remember, I guess, many slides back, where I was talking sort of introducing Frobenius splitting. What did I say? I said there's this theorem of Lakshmibai, Mehta, and Parameswaran says if the initial term is the product of the variables under some term order, then the divisor induces a splitting. And so we already knew that this D intersect U lambda was going to induce a splitting. But it's sort of interesting, at least, to notice that this splitting is of that form. We do have, I haven't described the term order yet, but there aren't very many variables here. You can probably choose a weighting, such that the initial term is the product of the variables. Okay, so let's apply the Knudsen-Lamspire algorithm here. I mean, we did that again before, but let's just see what are the ideals that we get. So the first one is the one that corresponds, first level down, the one on the left, that's the ideal that determines one of the components of the divisor. That was the determinant of that matrix. The other one was the B2 is 0. And we intersect and decompose and so on. Ask Macaulay 2 to do it or something. And we get all of these ideals. So I underlined under some term order what the initial term is going to be. And so you should notice at this point, all of the initial terms are these nice square-free monomial ideals. All of the initial ideals are square-free monomial ideals. Okay, so with respect to the term order, Revlex B2, Lex A2, Revlex B1, Lex A1, we get that each initial ideal for I compatibly split is a square free monomial ideal. So what do I mean by that term order? I mean, I Revlex B2. So I take the term with the least B2, right? That goes away. Now I lex A2. Okay, well, in this example it was sort of simple. And we're done. Great, I get a square-free initial term. Okay. And what do you do when you see square-free monomial ideals? Well, you can do some combinatorics. You can associate, using the Stanley-Reisner recipe, a square-free monomial ideal to a simplicial complex. And so in this picture, I'll explain, in case anybody hasn't seen that recipe, I'll explain it in a second, and then we'll go back to this example. But I guess I should say we get this decomposition of the three simplex, which I maybe mistakenly drew as unfolded to show sort of these back faces and interior edges, but you can think of this as it is the three simplex, and these spaces fold up, and we have a vertex out here, and all of these V2s are the same vertex, and it is filled in. The whole simplex corresponds to the whole U lambda. But in any case, you can sort of decompose this the three simplex using the Stanley-Reisner ideal. So, square free monomial ideals. I should just, I guess, briefly review how to do this correspondence in case anybody hasn't seen it. But whenever we have a square free monomial ideal, there's a one-to-one, we can correspond a simplicial complex and vice versa. There's a one-to-one correspondence. So let's just consider this example. I'll specify that the vertex set we're going to be using is V1 through V6, even though we don't see V6 there. Okay. So the square-free binomial ideal, or Stanley-Reisner ideal, of this simplicial complex that I'll call delta, in general, is the ideal I sub delta generated by the minimal non-faces of delta. Okay. And you can see that this ideal is then closed under taking products and so on. So what are the non-faces of delta? Well, V6 was in my vertex set list, but it's not even showing up. So V6 is a non-face. V1, V4, that line is not there. That's a non-face. Similarly, V1, V5, V2, V4, and the open, the face that I didn't color in, that V1, V2, V3. So on the other hand, if I'm given an ideal, I can associate a simplicial complex either by figuring out what the minimal non-faces should be, or easier, I guess, I can decompose the ideal into primes and then correspond the maximal dimensional faces to each one of those components. So what variables don't show up in here? V3 and V4, and that would be that edge. And this ideal, V1 and V2 don't show up, so that gives the V1, V2 edge. Okay, so back to this example. So, again, I didn't draw the pictures in anymore on this side because it was hard to fit them. Again, I under our Revlex Lex term order, I underlined the initial ideal, or the initial terms in each of the generators of the ideal, and so I can associate some simplicial complex to each one of them. So let's just look at one example, say this one, A2 B1 minus A1 comma B2, and if you skip back a few slides, which I won't do, that's the subvariety. One point is at the origin, and one point is floating freely. Okay. So we take the initial ideal, that's A2, B1, comma B2, decompose. We get two components, right? So this ideal that was originally prime, we take the initial ideal, becomes no longer prime. And we get this edge union that edge of the back face of this simplex. And we can do that for all of them, and we cover the simplex. So just one thing to note is that all of the variables show up here, and so that's the empty space. Okay. So that was kind of nice, that all of the compatibly split subvarieties degenerated to the Stanley-Reisner scheme, or a Stanley-Reisner scheme, and in particular, you can notice they're all balls. So that's homeomorphic to a ball, and when you fold this up and you look at these spaces out here, that's homeomorphic to a ball. Some of the There are some interior edges, maybe. But that's okay. Pardon me? Two split points. Yeah, you're right, yeah. So B1 and A2. So these sort of, these, the bolded ones. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so what can we say more general? Oh, sorry. Sorry, going the wrong way. Okay, sorry. So more generally, this happens, and this is a theorem of Allen's, that says if we have a term order on the polynomial ring k of x1 through k of xn, and we have some degree n polynomial such that there's a term order with the initial term, the product of the variables, which we had in the Hill 2 case, then what? Well, from the LMP theorem, we know that that induces a splitting. But furthermore, Allen says that if I is compatibly split with respect to our splitting, then init I, the initial ideal, is compatibly split with respect to the standard splitting. That is the one that's given by just the product of the variables. Okay? And so what does that mean? That means, well, we saw that the compatibly split ideals of the standard splitting were just these coordinate subspaces, which are given by square Freeman-Omial ideals. So if we have a splitting such that init I is the product of the variables, then all of the compatibly split subvarieties will have initial ideals that are square Freeman-Omial ideals. So luckily this applies for us. So I'm going to tell you sort of what happens in general, and then we can spend a little bit of time sort of going through an example. But in general, remember that all of the ideals or all of the elements of this U sub lambda, this open patch around this lambda, are ideals generated by these polynomials, where our variables, when we identify U lambda with affine space, are these AIs and these BIs. Okay? So now I'm going to let MN be the matrix of coefficients, sort of, that show up not including the first row. This A1 through AN, or minus A1 through minus AN, will be the first column, and then these CIJs will occur as the last column. And I say that the splitting divisor on U lambda is given by this polynomial Fn, which is Bn, which is the polynomial we get when we add the ideal x and say that it's not the idea, the sum is not 1, times the determinant of Mn for, again, the same reasons as in the two-point example. And then furthermore, if we consider the term order Revlex Bn, Lex An, Revlex Bn minus 1, Lex An minus 1, all the way down, we get that the initial term is the product of the variables. So again, what do I mean by that? I mean, take the fewest bn's, then take the most an's, then take the fewest bn minus 1, then the most an minus 1. So just an example to see this. I won't spend too much time doing this. Let's look at 4 points. Then the nice thing to see is these matrices sort of nest inside one another. And so start off with M4. And if you look at sort of the top 3x3 submatrix, you can see M3 inside of it, plus some extra terms that have B4s in them. And similarly, if you take M3 and you look at the top 2x2 submatrix, you can see M2 inside of M3, plus a term that has a B3 in it. Okay? So expand by cofactors along the last column, and we get that the determinant of M4 is the 4-4 entry times the determinant of M3 plus B4 times stuff. Okay? Then Revlex B4, and we get the 4-4 entry times the determinant of M3. Taking Lex, we get now this monomial times that M3. Okay? So just stuff we had above, or on the previous slide, is up there. So now, to our polynomial a4b3 dot m3, we rev lex b3 and lex a3, and we get that. And doing this once more yields that polynomial multiplied by minus b4, and we get the product of the variables. And then this generalizes. Okay. So, I mean, we have this term order now such that the initial term is the product of the variables. And so Allen's theorem tells us that all of our compatibly split subvarieties are going to degenerate to square Freeman-Ohmiel ideals, and we can associate a simplicial complex. So, I mean, one way you could do this was how we did it before. You know, take the ideal defining the subvariety, compute a Grosvenor basis, take the read off the initial terms, and so on. But that kind of is annoying. It would be difficult. It's difficult to do in general. I don't know how to do it in general. But luckily, we can, if we understand sort of how the degeneration works at each stage, sort of what's happening geometrically when we rev lex and when we lex and so on, then we can do everything sort of combinatorially. And so I think maybe I'm not going to really describe this. But we can essentially associate these words to a given strata in a completely combinatorial way, which says if I have L points floating freely generally and K points on the y-axis generally and some points at the origin generally, then I can basically take all of these different permutations in these letters where the A's are the AIs and the B's are the BIs, and A hat means A's not there, basically, to get these words which give me the facets of my simplicial complex. Okay? So, I mean, it's not so important to really understand what's going on here. And as I'm missing a couple details in the proof of the Lex degeneration in particular. So, again, this works. I can prove it, assuming that I know that the Lex degeneration is correct, and it works for all of the examples I've tried. But there's a step that I'm missing. But in any case, what does this give us? Well, we can sort of get some structure on the simplicial complexes that we associate to the strata using this sort of combinatorial recipe, or if you like, you can do it directly. So if there are no free points, that is, all of the points are on the axis or at the origin, no points are floating freely, I take the initial scheme of X, and I get affine space. That is, the simplicial complex that I get that I associate to the initial ideal is just a simplex. So semi-continuity gives us that the original, because we have this flat family, this flat Grosvenor degeneration, that all of those subvarieties are non-singular. Okay? The ones where you have just points on the axis or points at the origin. Okay, so now suppose that we do have some points floating freely, at least one floating freely. Well, if there are no points that are on the y-axis. Let me draw them to keep track. So. So no points are here. Then this guy degenerates to the Stanley Reisner scheme of a ball, really a vertex decomposable ball. And that's nice. And just something to note, that's sort of a difference between the case where you have a point on the y-axis and no points on the y-axis, is that in this case, the compatibly split subvarieties, codimension 1 subvarieties below it, degenerate onto the boundary of the ball. And in the second case, they don't. You get some interior edges. But in any case, in both of those two cases, you can conclude that, well, init x is Cohen-Macaulay by sort of a combinatorial fact that I don't actually know who it's attributed to. But in any case, init x is Cohen-Macaulay. And then again, you get the x's as well. Okay? So at least the subvarieties that have less than 2 points on the y-axis are Cohen-Macaulay. And finally, the remaining case isn't as nice. Unfortunately, they're not balls or spheres or nice like that. For example, if you have 2 points on the y-axis, then this degenerates to Stanley Reisner of sort of this cone on this sort of ugly complex that the non-R1 locus, which is the 3 points are on the axis, is this interior edge, and it's sort of triply branched along that edge. I mean, generally, you can say that if you have k greater than or equal to 2 points freely on the axis, then the non-R1 locus degenerates to a simplicial complex that's contained in k plus 1 facets of the original complex. But you can see just from this example that this doesn't have the same nice structure that the other ones did. So I guess that's really all I wanted to say. So I guess I'll just finish by saying that I guess it would be nice to understand also what happens around other lambdas, right, other fixed points, but I can't say anything about that yet. And then, of course, the general case, maybe it really is, hopefully it is understandable, but in any case, we saw that with this fixed point, things are a little better.